We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Paul Douglas, happy Thursday. Thank you for tuning in. Jordana has a timeout today. She's in detention. No, she's not. She just took a day off. And I'm grateful to Adam Carter for volunteering. We volunteered you to take her role today, Adam. Welcome.
Hi, Paul. You know, numb and number.
Good to have you here, buddy.
It's good to be here. You know, we could call this next 3 hours Numb and Number. I was thinking that'd be a great radio show title.
Numb and Number, one of my favorite movies, Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
But thank you for stepping in today and trying to keep me honest. I'm out east hanging out with Dad. He's 88. Can't hear to save his life. At the end of World War II, and thankfully, he was 15 when the war ended, so he was not drafted, or he would have become cannon fodder for the Third Reich. But the young people and the elderly were drafted against their will, kind of the last stand, and they taught everybody how to use bazookas. And so my 15-year-old dad is out there shooting bazookas at trees.
Wow.
And not wearing any hearing protection, so he can't hear. Which makes things a little bit challenging. But anyway, I'm grateful to be able to hang out with Dad, spend a little bit of time with him, and we're going to share some of his stories here coming up in just a few minutes.
Well, I remember the first time you had him on, there was quite a response to his stories, and not only just hearing the stories from your dad and many people of that age, the lessons we can learn, just the fascinating stories they have, but also the perspective it gives us in today's times. I think that's what hit home with a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased, of course, because he's my dad, and I love him, and I want to soak up as much time as I can. Every day is a gift, right? But, you know, we think, and many of us are having bad days, bad weeks, bad years, and some of his stories just make my hair curl in terms of what he went through, what everybody in World War II went through. And I think we have to remember those stories and pass them on to our kids and their kids. And hopefully we never go through a situation like that again. But hey, I wanted to update listeners a little bit on Michael. I know it's one of the few things we don't have to worry about here in Minnesota, but unimaginable destruction over the Florida Panhandle. Have you seen some of the video, some of the pictures, Adam?
Well, the fascinating thing I was looking at today is in Mexico Beach, a community that basically has been wiped out by Hurricane Michael. They had drone footage. You know, they send these drones up now, and they send them over the landscape, and it is absolutely devastating. What stands out right now is a couple of things, I think. Sadly, this number likely will go higher and will go higher, but the death toll right now, only two people. Secondly, though, is just the storm surge yesterday when they're talking about that water just coming ashore and basically taking out everything in its path, not only the water and the wind. It's hard to wrap your head around the power of that thing and the fact that those winds were sustained well onto land. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, this thing was still a hurricane when it swirled into Georgia. But you're right. I mean, the power of moving water. This was almost a one-story storm surge, 9 to 11 Jeez. Feet. And it wasn't the winds per se. The winds didn't help, of course, but it was just the battering ram effect of surge after surge of water being pushed ashore by those winds and by the low pressure. They're calling it unimaginable destruction. I mean, it looks like a bomb went off. It was the most powerful hurricane to strike the U.S. in 50 years. Chunks of U.S. 98 in Panama City have been washed away, one of the main drags. Tyndall Air Force Base reporting extensive damage. They had a wind gust to 129 miles an hour. I saw video runways submerged. airplanes, jets flipped over. 81 miles of Interstate 10 had to be closed just to clean away the debris, the fallen trees. They estimate maybe a few million trees knocked over from this thing. 900,000 people still without power from Florida into parts of North Carolina. So, yeah, this, and again, Panama City, Mexico Beach, St. Joe. I mean, it's a relatively lightly populated part of Florida. You know, what sends tingles up my spine, trepidation and fear, is if this kind of a storm were to push into Tampa, yeah, or Miami or even Jacksonville. And again, I don't think any of us can really understand what this is like. It really was the rough meteorological equivalent of a 40-mile-wide EF3 tornado.
Jeez.
Only this one lasted 1 to 2 hours. And you look at the damage with these homes shredded. You know, the condos, concrete, steel-reinforced, homes that were up on stilts, some of those survived. But regular wood-frame buildings that weren't elevated, that weren't on stilts, most of those were just swept away and became kindling. So unbelievable.
I was reading an article about the effect that Andrew had, Hurricane Andrew, when that hit southeastern Florida, I think 92. And then the buildings, the changes they made to buildings in that zone. But I'm wondering, when you have a storm of that magnitude with those winds, does it even matter? I mean, can you build strong enough to sustain? I mean, even like I'm talking about personal homes. I mean, it's one thing to have a big commercial building, but can you build just regular homes that would sustain those kinds of winds?
It's a great question, and the answer is yes, and it costs about 20% more,
right,
to be able to build out of concrete and reinforced steel. And coming up and beyond the headlines at 4:35, we talk about some people that are doing just that, that are trying to build homes that will stand the test of time. Hurricane-proof, fire-proof, earthquake-proof. It is being done. It's a cottage industry, but I think it's going to be a growing industry and an opportunity for contractors, for people who say, yeah, I'm willing to pay extra, but I want to make sure, come hell or high water, literally, my home is left standing. It is being done, and we'll talk about that at about 4:35. We'll also talk about the snow up north. We had the first flurries of the season, even in the metro, overnight between 3:30 and 4:30, and a few inches of snow up north. But when we come back, let's chat with Folker and see what kind of trouble he can get me into. That's next on CCO. Okay, thank you for joining us. Jordana has the day off. I'm here with my dad, Folker. We are about 75 miles west of Philly in Lancaster, and this is where I grew up, went to school at Penn State, got my meteorology degree. Dad always helped to fan that curiosity. Every morning I would come down, and next to the bowl of cereal would be some weather clippings from the local newspaper, weather-related stories. And so I credit Dad, among various science teachers, in getting me interested and keeping me interested in science and meteorology. Again, Dad can't hear. What we hope to do, I'm going to be back in second week of November, and I want to take listener questions then. He can't really hear very well, but I can point to the screen and he can read some of your questions, and we hope to do that the next time around. Dad, welcome back to the show.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Adam, and thank you very much for inviting me back on your show. It's good to be back. What was the question? What would you like me to talk about?
At the end of World War II, it was chaos. Mm-hmm. It was anarchy.
Yes.
And you were 15 years old. You were with your family.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about what it was like at the end of World War II.
Yes. Go back to the first few days in May of 1945. I was a 14-year-old kid. The Russian front was coming closer and closer. We could hear the guns get louder day by day, and we had no idea what would happen. You don't know when a front rolls over you. Will they bomb? Will they destroy the village? Will they burn it down? Anyway, most of the people in the village fled into the nearby woods. I remember we arrived there at night, stayed overnight, and the next morning we stepped out into a clearing, and here, right before our eyes, were German soldiers literally running, and I mean at the top of their lungs, running, no weapons, no hats, just running west. It was the difference between being taken prisoner by the British or Americans or winding up in Siberia. So that image I never forgot. A few hours later, the Russian lines came through, as you see it in the movies, a long line. Guys with machine pistols, everybody was frisked, nobody was killed. We moved back into the village, and on the way back, here, right on a huge pasture outside our village, was the biggest dump of war machinery that you could imagine. There was everything that the American army, apparently, that the German army had been fleeing with, moving towards the west. There were tanks. There were army buses. There were pieces of light and heavy artillery. And scattered around in between were a few thousand rounds of ammunition, tank ammunition, light artillery. We just gasped. What you didn't see were light vehicles, passenger cars, motorcycles, and bicycles. Apparently, the heavy machinery had run out of gas, and anything that would still have gas was used to drive or pedal to the American lines. So that was very impressive, and sometime in the future I will have a story on how we played with some very light artillery pieces at age 14.
Yeah, not a good idea to mess around with anti-artillery. But again, anything with wheels, if you made it to the west, if you made it to the American front, the British front, you would stay alive.
Yes, anything with wheels. But usually wheels, unless you had a bicycle, anything with wheels needed gas. And gas was in short supply at the time. So most of the soldiers were walking, which brings me to story number two. Bear with me. About 7 years later, I was a manager of an American restaurant within the base of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I had been a student at a university in Indiana. I spoke English, and I came back to Germany, and on the basis of having worked in a grocery store, I was made manager of 23 people. Of course, I had no idea. But being on a base, I had access to Stars and Stripes. Some of you older generation may recognize it. It was, and I think still is, the official newspaper of the U.S. Armed Forces. In that newspaper, I come across a story with a unique headline, which I will tell you at the end of this story. But reading the first paragraph, I see the name of a town and said, good grief. This town was less than 10 miles from where we lived. And here is the marvelous story. Two American sergeants in a jeep. On the rear was mounted a heavy machine gun, and also on the rear was flying a very huge American flag, so there could be no mistaking that they were Germans or Russians. Anyway, they very penetrated miles and miles into what in a couple of days would become Russian territory. They progressed towards the Russian lines very slowly, driving through a wooded stretch, and a German lieutenant steps out, salutes, and says, "Sir," he wore a white flag, of course, "Sir, I'm here and I'm authorized to offer you the surrender of a number of German troops." Sergeant looks at him, says, "Okay, what are we talking about?" "Quite a few." "What's quite a few? What are we talking about? 100, 200, 500? "No, sir, much, much more." "How much more, son?" "Many thousands." "Can you be more specific? I have to read your back." "Oh, sir, we're talking about 250,000. Damon says, "Are you pulling my leg?" "No, sir. I'm absolutely serious. In the woods here are the remnants of several German divisions. We're trying to make our way to the American lines." So the sergeant gets on the phone, calls his base, says, "Hey, guys, I got a German lieutenant here who wants to surrender 250,000 German troops." A long silence. Then, "Hey, Sarge, are you pulling our leg?" "No, sir. I believe the guy." Another long pause. They come back, then the base came on and say, "Okay, Sergeant, here's what you do. Take him out of the woods, assemble him on the street, walk him down to our lines, and you bring up the rear. Make sure they get here safely." And 2 days later, Stars and Stripes comes out with his headlines. "Two American sergeants take 250,000 Germans prisoner." So there's a little P.S. and a personal observation, if I may. These jeeps, these are lightly armed jeeps, and this was not the only one. I heard of several others, were sent into what would become Russian territory in a few days. And nothing happened in that war without Eisenhower's okay. Here's the question. Why did he did it? Why did he do it? What here? My interpretation and that of some people I talked to, did he do it to save German soldiers from being taken to Siberia and probably certain death? So if that is the case, it was an unprecedented act of human kindness shown towards the enemy to preserve German lives. I don't think there's any other explanation, because the lines of occupation, the occupation zones, were established a year before in Yalta, and the jeeps that were going towards the Russian lines definitely were going into Russian territory, in the future Russian territory. So that is the story of Stars and Stripes, which I saw 7 years later. And I still think it was a wonderful deed, wonderful act by General Eisenhower.
Thank you, Dad. Every time I come back, I have new stories, and yes, I'm keeping track of the stories, and whether Dad wants to or not, we're going to write a book together and hopefully preserve some of these stories so I can pass them on to future grandkids. But thank you. We'll be back with more stories from Falker when we come back on CCO.
And the Prep Sports Spotlight is brought to you by Old Dutch Foods.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Paul with you. Adam Carter joining us today. Thank you, Adam. And I'm out east in Lancaster hanging out with my 88-year-old father who has some amazing stories to tell. At least I think they're amazing. And thanks to those of you that are weighing in One of you wrote, thank you, Paul, and your dad. My husband's dad is 99, served 4 years in multiple countries for the U.S. Wish we could have recorded his dad in time to share these stories. Any chance you're doing a podcast? I have no idea. It's actually a good idea. Jordana put together an amazing podcast for CCO Radio in conjunction with the Star Tribune, talking about sexual assaults and humanizing that story. And I'd love to do something. I just think it's important that I try to document these stories while I can. A few years from now, I don't want to look back and say coulda, shoulda, woulda. Dad, welcome back. You still
can't. Good to be back.
Okay, now tell me.
I wasn't sure I would get a second chance to talk today, but it's very nice. Thank you. We want to talk about my old teacher, Ilse Dürge.
Ilse Dürge, yes. Tell us about, you know, we talk a lot about the statistics of war and the chaos at the end of World War II, but there was obviously an ongoing human dimension here. Talk about Ilse, and you have an amazing, I think it's an amazing story.
Yeah, fast forward from the end of the war to 1990, that was the year when Germany was being reunited. The old communist part of Germany no longer existed, and I found out where my old teacher, who was the first one to teach us English and German and history, what happened to her. Because in the fall of 1945, when school started again, the war was over, my teacher was missing. She wasn't there. Nobody knew what happened. So I just had to accept it. Maybe she died. Then I heard in 1990 that she was alive, 90 years old, and living not too far away. So my wife, my daughter Joan, and I made a date, and we saw her. And wonderful greeting with coffee and cake. And I had to ask her, what happened to you? What happened to you? This is 45 years later. She said, well, I have a story for you. Remember, in a year before the end of the war, we got a new principal. Of course, I didn't remember. But so she said, when we got the new principal, that was in 1944, he assembled everybody in the teacher's lounge and said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your new principal. I'm a member of the Nazi Party. Actually, it's called National Socialist Party. I'm an admirer of Adolf Hitler. And I noticed that some of you are not yet members of the party. If you want to teach at my school, I would like you to take out membership in the Nazi Party. And if you can do this, we will on Monday march down to City Hall. You will take out membership, and you will get the little pin in your lapel, and I expect you to wear it proudly. If you can't take that step, I'm afraid I will have to accept your resignation. So Ilse Dürge said, I had no choice. I had to teach. I had no way of making a living. So we all traipsed down, and every last teacher who had not been a member of the Nazi Party became a member of the Nazi Party, and that was it. By the way, we as pupils never paid any attention to it. Anyway, fast forward to 1990, where we were sitting there. I said, okay, you became a member of the Nazi Party, then what? He says, now hear my story. This is the second part. In the fall of 1945, about 6 months after the armistice, we all assembled back at the school. We had heard the school reopened, and we heard there was a new principal. We all sat down in the teacher's lounge. Everything was the same. The furniture, the desks, the only thing that had changed, the Hitler picture, Hitler's portrait on the wall, had been replaced by one of Ernst Thälmann, who was an old German communist. So here in walks the new principal, and he greets us very, very cordially and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy you survived the end of the war. It was terrible. Now we're here. We're starting a new year. I was just freed from a concentration camp. I spent several years there because I'm a communist. And I'm more than ever, I'm a convinced communist, and I must expect that if you want to teach at my school, I expect you to take out membership in the Communist Party. Today is Friday, and you have a weekend to think about, and let me know your decision on Monday morning. If you cannot take that step, I will be happy to accept your resignation because you will no longer be able to teach at this school." At this point, Elsie Dagel got up and said, "Sir, I sold my soul, once. I cannot do it again. Goodbye." That was it. So I said, "Hey, that was 45 years ago. What did you do? How did you live?" He says, "I couldn't teach at any school. I did some work for the Evangelical Church. I gave some, I helped students who needed remedial input, which was illegal. I inherited the house of my parents, so I lived rent-free. I made it okay. So no regrets." I said, "This is wonderful. We had coffee and cake, and we had a very good time. We left, and guess what? 2 years later, no, 2 months later, there's a letter in the mail from her, from Elsie Dagel, and she says, you can't imagine. I got a letter. I'm getting my full pension, as if I had been working 45 years. This was from the new German government. And somebody in the West had kept track of the injustices that were done in the communist part of Germany. So the West Germans must have had an agency. Imagine the many people who had suffered in injuries and injustices. Apparently they knew the fate of everybody, and I got my full pension as if I had been teaching for 45 years. She lived 2 more years, and I'm very happy that we made that trip and met her and got this story. Yeah, that was about it.
Dad, before we go, you have a special shout-out to some special people in Minnesota, right? You want to?
Yes. Thank you. I would like to say hello and a shout out to some old friends and customers of mine at West Publishing. In the 80s and 90s, we worked very closely together. Maybe you remember Volker Krewhofer from Science Press. I was vice president sales and marketing, and we worked very closely. And I would like to read a few names, and maybe somebody is listening. At the top of the list is John Lindley. I believe it was Dr. Lindley, and he was head of the college department. Here are a few other names. Ted Bornhoft, Tim Reedy, Don Voigt, Jeff Carpenter, and Tom Hill. I'm reading from an old Rolodex. I can't read my writing. Anyway, if anybody knows them, if anybody is still alive, and I hope you are, it would be nice if you can call into this show and tell them you remember us, and I wanted to use this opportunity to thank you for all the kindness, and it was great working with you. And if you call in, Paul will pass the word, and I will hear about it.
Thank you, Dad. But your story about Elsa really brings the point home that if we don't learn the lessons of history, we just keep repeating history. But Adam Carter, I'll let you take over and take us up to Wixon time. But yeah. Thank you, Dad. Appreciate that. Adam, I'll toss it back to you.
Good stuff. Thank you, Paul. And thank you very much. The Wixon Jewelers time is now 3:49. Wixon pays more for your used watch. Trade in your current watch towards the watch of your dreams at Wixon Jewelers.
Paul Douglas with Adam Carter. Adam, thank you for hanging in there during that.
You got it. Very interesting stuff. I mean, like you said, and like people are saying, the idea, and, you know, you were doing the radio show, and that'll be on the podcast, so you'll have that forever. And you think about the chances you get to talk with your parents, especially as they get older, you get older, bringing out the tape recorder and sitting down and getting some of those stories on tape. It's something that's so easy to do, especially nowadays. We all got a nice tape recorder on our phone.
Yep.
So what a great idea for people to do that, you know, especially as we approach the holiday season. You know, carve out 20 minutes, half hour with your loved ones and get some of the better stories on tape. It's a super idea and very interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember what I did yesterday. Dad has vivid memories from 70 years ago, and it's like, I wish I had inherited that gene, but... And he has thousands of these stories, so my goal is to get as many of them down as I can. And whether or not there's a book or a podcast, I want to save these for my boys and hopefully their kids. But, we have so much to learn from the older generation. There really is an accumulation of wisdom that we should take advantage of, especially in these crazy times, right? We can learn a lot from our parents and from our grandparents.
Crazy times, too, on Wall Street. I know we're going to be talking about this coming up next hour, but that the Dow finished down another 545 points today.
Oof.
I mean, that combined with the 800-and-some-point loss yesterday, 831 points yesterday. And I know next hour we're going to be talking to David Wilson with Bloomberg about what's driving the markets down. And you look at some of the figures from this sell-off on Wall Street, and you know, if you've got the key to that on why stocks go up and down and fluctuate like that, I mean, you obviously make a lot of money, but that is a head-scratch of the last couple of days.
It is, and I don't know, you know, if it really is a cause for panic or if this is a buying opportunity.
A blip, yep.
I mean, the psychology is fascinating. People buy when they should be selling and sell when they should be buying. And so, I don't know, do we just take a deep collective breath and hope it blows over? But we talked to an expert at 410. 510, we talked to somebody on the ground in Florida to get more perspective on Michael and the extent of the damage down there. And I think we're also having a chat about Jimmy Butler, aren't we, at 5:35?
The drama does not end, Paul. And today, now, Jimmy apparently had a team-only meeting today where he challenged the team again, but apparently that, at least for the foreseeable future, he'll be with the team and possibly play with them next Wednesday night when they open the season. But we've got another member of the team, Jeff Teague, who never tweets, but today he's tweeting saying, no, that team meeting didn't happen. What do we believe? And the drama continues, and there's plenty of questions and hopefully some answers. But, hey, I mean, the spotlight is on the Timberwolves, and they have yet to play a game, but it's quite the soap opera there.
Well, it has generated additional interest in the Wolves, but it sounds a little like a bad made-for-TV mini-drama. I mean, it's reality TV, right?
It certainly is, and Dan Cook is here. Apparently, we've got a late addition to the show.
Yeah, we're also going to talk at 5:20 to the acting city manager administrator up in Duluth, because Florida is getting pounded, and that's, you know, obviously the chief weather story. But there's some serious damage going on up in Duluth too as well. So we'll get a live update on what's going on up there.
Did you see the pictures, Paul? Did you happen to see the pictures from Split Rock Lighthouse and the spray that was coming up? I mean, the Split Rock Lighthouse is like 130 feet above the lake, and the spray was coming up to the lighthouse. It's just incredible pictures yesterday.
Hurricane force winds. Yeah. I saw a wind gust to 89 miles an hour. Hurricane force is 74. So, yeah, reports of 20-foot waves. This has, by the way, nothing to do with Michael.
Yeah.
Everything to do with the cold air that's coming in. But perspective on that. We're going to jam as much as we can into the next 2 hours.
Very good, Paul. Stay tuned. Get a cup of coffee. We got plenty coming up next hour. Again, we're going to be talking to David Wilson, Bloomberg columnist, about the markets being down again today. That, another keyword for cash opportunity coming up next hour. It's all coming up on WCCO. It's 3:58. Paul Douglas, Adam Carter along for the ride today. We got 38 degrees and blustery. Stay tuned. CBS News coming up and Laura's News on 830 WCCO.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.